Hi, I'm Tim.
I'm Jenny.
And we are
the Irreverends. I'm sorry, that's right, we're too perky. We have to have a Lent version of this, like the Era Voices, and we are the Irreverends. Or we are the Irreverends.
This is CNN.
Okay, this is the Irreverends. Okay, that sounds better.
Hi, I'm Tim.
Yeah, I'm Jenny.
You know, Lent's not really about...
No, it's not, but you know what's sad? Is that last week we recorded this the day before our new school shooting.
Yeah, that was horrible. What a horrible Ash Wednesday.
It would have been a very different program had we recorded it after.
It's true.
Although, how appropriate it was in some ways that it was Ash Wednesday to just remind us of the fleeting nature of things, but also to know that God can make anything out of ashes. So Lent itself is not supposed to be morose and sad. There is a part of my spirit that feels just morose and sad.
Yeah, I think that's, unless you're just pissed off, that's where everybody is.
Well, but even pissed off comes from a place of shock and sadness.
That's true.
But you know what? We are a people of a story that encompasses every kind of sadness and brokenness that the world has to give. So let's look at the stories.
Let's do it. And our first reading comes from the book of Genesis. Chapter 17, verses 1 through 7, skip, then verses 15 through 16. And again, there's always something interesting in what gets passed over.
I bet Tim read the skip.
I bet you're right. And what goes after, too.
Ooh, nice. Like nice work.
Context. Oh, yeah. All right, so.
He's done his homework, and let the record reflect, Jenny has not. Okay, as if anybody who knows me is surprised by that.
All right, the lesson. When Abram, remember, it's Abram at this point. That's important later.
You say remember, but not everybody ever knew that.
Well, okay, so it's Abram at this point. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant between me and you and will make you exceedingly numerous. Then Abram fell on his face and God said to him, As for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be the ancestor of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the ancestor of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you, throughout their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and to your offspring after you. God said to Abraham, As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall give rise to nations. Kings of peoples shall come from her. Here endeth the lesson.
Wow.
All right. So, this is, in fact, God's second covenant with Abram. The first covenant happening some 24 years before this. Abram's now 99. Sarah's also in her 90s, according to the biblical age reckoning.
The story of Abram and Sarai, as they start out, but we all know them as Abraham and Sarah, their story, they're already old when it begins.
Yep.
And it says things had ceased to be the way of women with her.
Yeah.
I understand her pain. So they're already old when this starts. And they have followed God, and God has not yet done what God said he was going to do.
Right. Fulfilled this promise that was made 24 years earlier. So in the meantime, you have the episode with Hagar.
Love her.
And
the episode with Hagar is where Hagar was Sarah's slave. The culture of the time allowed a woman to give her servant to her husband, and any children born of that union would be considered the wife's children, like were the wife's children. Mm-hmm. The slave was just considered a surrogate. So they've done that, and Ishmael has been born.
And Ishmael's important for us in modern times because he is considered by Muslims to be the father
of Islam.
So.
And Sarah hates Hagar and Ishmael.
She gets a little jello afterwards. She is, as my British friends would say, well gel.
Yeah, she is. They represent her failure as a woman.
Right.
And maybe also God's failure to fulfill the promise the way they expected it would be fulfilled.
So now God pops back up and says, okay, it's time to, I don't know if it's really recommitting the promise or a revision of the promise, but this, what's known as the second covenant is made. And what's interesting here from a lectionary standpoint, for me, like usual, is what the lectionary committee decided to leave out.
Right.
So he does the broad majority of chapter 17 of Genesis, but it skips a few things, and then it skips the end of the chapter. And in those things are three things that probably we would find unpleasant as Christians, maybe. So maybe that's why they did it. I don't know. But the first one is the land promise. All right, so this is probably written by the priestly source. So if you look at the biblical, you know, scientific biblical history, you have four sources in Genesis, and this is written by the priestly source, this segment, which generally would be a little bit more in line with projecting the power of Israel. So the first thing that the lectionary committee skips over is the land promise, which is interesting for me, considering, you know, the complications of what that is used for in modern times.
Well, the land promise, meaning spelling out where the land is that God has given Abraham.
Right.
And BTW, there are already people there.
Yeah. And basically, you know, ultimately, there's a command to slaughter those people. So it gets a little complicated. The circumcision requirement, which makes every guy uncomfortable.
Smarts. Yeah.
Yeah. Literally smarts.
Yeah.
That's interesting because in this particular covenant, as opposed to the covenant we read about last week with Noah, there is a requirement.
Yeah.
And that is, you've got to cut off your foreskin, which, you know, I guess maybe people in the pews don't really want to hear anyway. But that's skipped over. And then after where we end the reading, there's this part that's really interesting for me because of the contrast that's made a little bit later. Abraham laughs. He falls down and he laughs.
I don't remember that.
Abraham laughs and says,
because of course we know Sarah laughs later.
Yeah, just the next chapter. The Oaks of Mamre's of the very next chapter. Abraham laughs because, which is demonstrable of, you know, maybe a little bit of doubt or something. Because, you know, he's 99. Sarah's over 90. She is no longer menstruating. Let's just say what it means.
Well, she hasn't been in more than
20 years. You know, there's this part, and God even says there that the name of her child will be Isaac, which means laughter, which we also hear a reprise of in the next chapter. And so it's interesting to me because we bag on Sarah for having the doubt and laughing.
Right.
And then there's this whole thing where God says, you were laughing. She's like, no, I wasn't. It's like, oh, yes, you were.
Yeah.
Right? But Abraham gets a free pass from the lectionary committee, at least.
So I didn't even know. I didn't remember, because I have read this through.
No one does. No one remembers that Abraham laughed first.
But the fact of their laughter feels... So what happens later is the angels come to them to actually say, Sarah's going to get pregnant, you know, imminently. And Sarah is overhearing them, and she laughs. And they say to her, why did you laugh? She says, I didn't laugh. And they say, oh, yes, you did laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Which is such a snag. The fact that they laugh tells me that what really hits me about this story now, with everything going on in the world, is that they have been faithful as they can as humans, to what God has called them to do. And for more than 20 years...
Nothing's happened.
They took matters into their own hands with the Hagar thing.
And there was also the passing Sarah off as his sister thing.
Oh, yeah, that's why I said they've been faithful as best they can as humans.
Sorta.
But in terms of feeling that the promise to them is fulfilled.
Right.
When it wasn't happening year after year, I can imagine their, especially Sarah's, because for a woman not to have a child was her shame. Like, her whole role is to bear a child.
Right.
And for her, for month after month, year after year, for her not to get pregnant dashes her hope, makes her feel like a fool for ever having hoped. Eventually, they take matters into their own hand with the whole Hagar thing, but that is not fulfilling to Sarah. She can't, no matter how much the culture allows it, she cannot look upon this child as her own.
Yeah.
The fact that God makes the covenant again, first of all, is very meaningful to me because it's God's recognizing that they needed to hear it again. They needed God to reiterate God's promise and answer back what certainly has been their prayer all along. Where are you? Where is our promise? And when I say that this reminds me of our times today, people have been praying for God to, you know, lift the scourge of gun violence. And then it doesn't happen. And then people say, why not? How long? I say how long because that's a refrain in so many of the Psalms. Or people, you know, an end to slavery and then an end to racism. And because God doesn't respond the way people expect God to respond, people start doubting God. So what I find particularly touching right now is that God comes back physically present to make this covenant again.
A reminder.
Yeah. And they laugh to show their sort of bitterness. Like, this is hilarious. Like, really? After 24 years? Like, really? Like, we're even older and more shrivelly than we used to be.
Right.
So I find this particularly moving right now.
And it's also moving because there's basically like the three themes that come out of the covenant, the promises that God gives in the covenant. I mean, he requires, you know, a little bit.
He requires
Abraham to put a little skin in the game, if you know what I mean.
Ooh, ba-dum-bum.
Hey.
Yeah.
But God promises.
Well, an everlasting mark.
Right.
Yeah.
God promises.
It gets them right where they live, right?
Well, hey. God promises in return forgiveness, belonging with God, and freedom in their own place, their own land.
Well, but also legacy.
Yeah.
Which for our Jewish brothers and sisters, who especially at this time in their formation, just so early on, there were no strains of Judaism that had the idea of an afterlife. There might be now, or some of the mystical parts of Judaism might now, generally speaking,
and
Judaism...
And by now you mean when this is written, or what do you say?
Maybe by the time this was written. Ancient Judaism had no idea of an afterlife. That what carried on was your legacy as an ancestor. That you lived on through the lives of your children, grandchildren. You lived on through your line, which is why having children was more important even today, because the idea was you disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
You disappeared from history. You ceased to exist if you didn't have children. Nobody was there to carry on your story and your legacy. So God gives them a future, not just an immediate future with land, but an everlasting future.
And that everlasting future, from a Christian standpoint, is that ultimately Jesus comes from this line.
And everlasting future from a whole earth standpoint is that Ishmael has come from this line.
Yeah.
Also. So let's, since you mentioned Christianity,
let's have a
peek at the gospel. The gospel, again, is from Mark, chapter 8, verses 31 to 38. Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed, when he comes in the glory of his Father, the holy angels." Word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Yeah. Woo. Okay. Love this line, "Get behind me, Satan."
Poor Peter.
Just a little, I know. Okay, you gotta love Peter. But, you know, this is just a little personal aside. This is one of my little rebukes to myself. Those little voices inside your head that tell you if you were just better at this, or if you were just smarter, or everything's my fault, or all those things, you know, those, I'm quite sure I'm not the only person
who has those little doubts that pop up over and over.
Oh my God, that narrative, that sort of never-ending voice. At my best, I will recognize that voice and I will say in my head, get behind me, Satan. The reason for that is not because I think I'm possessed by demons, but because it's a reminder that that voice, I am putting my mind, I need to put my mind on divine things. That voice is not a voice that God put inside me. Mm-hmm. That is just a doubt that's focused more on failings. And in this time, there's all kinds of thoughts about who a Messiah will be. One of them, though, is not that the Messiah will be killed.
Especially not, you know, stripped naked, nailed to a cross.
No. And when Jesus says this is what's going to happen, and it says he spoke very plainly about it, Peter was like, stop.
Wait, what?
Yeah, this is not, you should not be saying this. This is not who you are. What are you saying? Because remember, Peter's the guy who's got no filter.
Right.
He just says.
Well, and just right before this, Peter has proclaimed that Jesus is the Messiah.
Right. Yeah, this right before this is when
this is happening
says,
all at Caesarea Philippi at the base of Mount Hermon where the springs of the Jordan come out of the snowpack. And the interesting thing about that place is this is historically, at this point in time, a place where Caesar would have had a statue erected that basically proclaimed, I am the Son of God and you guys get water because I let you get water.
Ugh.
Right. This is a really political act that Jesus is doing here
right
by saying, all right, so here we are. You know that there's this idol up the way, you know, that's meant to represent our oppressor. Who do you say I am?
Right. Because he said, who do the people say that I am? And they answer, well, some say Elijah and some say the prophets. And Jesus says, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter is the one who says, you right are the Messiah.
And then not more than five verses later, he's getting repeated.
Yeah, like five steps later. And Jesus says, well, here's what the Messiah, I know you guys have in your mind what the Messiah will look like. You know, that the Messiah will overthrow Rome, or the heavens will crack open and God's kingdom will come here and any of this will matter. But I'm telling you, this is what it's actually going to look like. And you can imagine Peter is crushed and disoriented.
Right.
So that's where this comes from. Get behind me, Satan. It's really just, those are not, you can't hear my story. Don't impose your story over mine.
And this isn't, I mean, like the end of the relationship with Peter by any way, shape, or form. Because just, you know, in a couple more verses, you get to the transfiguration story we had a few weeks ago.
This is, actually, in some ways, I feel like this shows the realness of their relationship. First of all, the intimacy where Peter will pull him aside as his, like, trusted advisor.
Yeah.
Saying, hey, I don't know if you realize that, but, you know, like,
this can't be the way it works.
Yeah. The stuff you're laying down, yeah, that's not what we're expecting. But that Jesus rebukes him, that's the sign of a real friendship, where you can be angry with one another. You can be true with one another. And Peter doesn't leave. Peter doesn't leave now.
No.
So let's just get to this thing about, for those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will save it. That's some big stuff.
What doth it profit a man?
That's the King James Version.
Yes.
Yeah, Tim's been in England. Aren't you going to say that, like, with a merry English accent?
No, I'm good.
Okay, so what does this mean? What does it mean? We could answer you in sort of liberal theology. What does it mean? But partly what you need to do is talk to people who have experience of this to tell you what it meant for them. I'll give you just a little glimpse of mine, but mine's weird because since Tim and I are priests, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to, that giving up your life means you have to be a priest.
No, because, you know, the world would cease to work if that happens.
If we were all priests. And this actually is something that happens every day. The idea is you have to give up your own expectation, your own sort of narrative of what life means for you and what's valuable and where you're going. What's happened here is that Peter has laid down for him Peter's expectations of what a savior is supposed to be.
And frankly, Peter's expectations were what the society at large
wanted.
Expected.
And so there was nothing unusual in that. And Jesus says that's not, you can't have your own expectations and cling to them. You have to lay down that.
Right.
And let come what God has coming. So I was a lawyer and a suburban mom of two young children and had an epiphany that what I really needed to be was a priest. For me, one of the first really obvious moments where I thought about this oh, this is what it means, that if you want to save your life, you have to lose it, was I have to lay down my expectation of the path that I thought my life was going to go and be willing to lose it, to really let go of that whole expectation of what that path was going to be. And I have to, and what I will do is find what my life was really meant to be. That is sort of a dramatic description of it. But over and over again in your life, this idea of setting down what the culture expects, setting down what sort of like your human fears would drive you to, you know, the accumulation of goods or a bigger house, or if I just work more, if I, you know, just get to the bottom of my Facebook feed.
Yeah. If I could only clear out my email box.
Oh, my God. Right. That you have to lay that down, because that's what your human nature says. That's what the world says. But that is not necessarily what God says. It doesn't mean that you, it doesn't, this is why I was a little hesitant to tell my story, but it doesn't mean that you have to lay down your life and go and live in the desert and be a hermit, or go off to Africa and, you know, build orphanages or bring fresh water to villages or whatever.
No. But what it does mean is that you have to be willing to say, I'm going to set aside this part that is attached to my ego in some way, shape, or form,
right,
to serve the immediate need around me.
To serve, right. I mean, that's a great test. To serve God's needs.
God's people.
So to lay down your life does not mean to kill yourself. It doesn't mean to quit your job and sell all your things and move to the wilderness. It can mean something as simple as laying down your sense of importance and picking up the hand of somebody in need.
Mm.
So, okay, so let's do Lectio. And it is my turn to pick. So, here we go. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? What stands out for you?
Forfeit their life. In light of what we were just talking about, you know, flipping that on its head, not saying, you know, giving it all up, but saying it doesn't matter if you have accumulated all these things and power and prestige and everything,
yeah,
if you have not lived the life you were made to live, the fullness that you were made to have in life.
Right.
If you have not followed the path that God not necessarily laid out for you, because, you know, we aren't by no means people that believe in predestination, you and I, but there is a path that God dreams of for you,
right,
I believe. And I've lived a life where I have accumulated and, you know, I had the six-figure job and on the surface, everything seemed like it should be perfect, but I was empty.
Mm.
And, you know, now I am doing something completely other.
Right.
And much more fulfilled, much more myself. And
much so it's life-giving.
Yeah, it's much more life-giving. So that's what stands out to me. The idea that it's not what the world tells you is success, but real success is living what God dreams of for you.
So I also, the word life stuck out for me. Life is where the breath and the blood. So wait, let me give you an analogy. I have two stories. One was with our cat and one was with my youngest child. Trying to clip their nails and hitting the cat, the quick, and for Andrew, cutting his finger a little. So in cats and dogs, the quick is inside that thick nail, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's where the lifeblood is. It's where the growth comes.
Right.
And to, you want to get close to it, but to clip it hurts them because that's where the life is, right? And if you are not living a life that is at that place where growth happens, where pain can happen, the lifeblood isn't there, then that's why people end up empty.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's all this social science research and psychology research now that says that actually way more money doesn't make you way more happy. That there's sort of a median amount of money. I think it's $75,000, but that would have to be adjusted by where you live because of housing prices and stuff. Right. There is that way more money, way more powerful power. People think that's going to make them happy because they think it's going to make them feel safe. And in reality, it just makes them anxious or empty because they're not, their life doesn't have that lifeblood in it. And people then seek out adventure and bungee jumping and world traveling and all these things to try to fill that, when the problem is that there's not that sense of feeling and risk and connection with that place where life and growth happens. I'm not articulating this very well, but life is so rich and full if you live it in that place of vulnerability, if you live it in that place and share it with people. So what's our prayer? I just have a prayer that people live their life from someplace other than fear, because I feel like fear is consuming us right now. Fear of scarcity, fear that our government is out of control, fear of guns, fear of violence, fear of other, fear of the fear that the NRA taps into, fear that the government is going to take your guns, or that there's going to be some sort of apocalyptic thing and you're going to have to defend your family. Fear makes us withdraw, and it might seem like that sort of lifeblood and aliveness, but it is anxiety. It's not.
Fear makes us malleable for the forces that manipulate us on all sides. It doesn't matter which part of a spectrum or any spectrum you're looking at. The powers use fear to make us malleable towards their end.
And fear does not let in the other.
Right. And it's in relationship with the other that
you find freedom.
Yeah. But that requires leaving your quick out there exposed.
Yeah. Yeah, letting that's hard. Life. Yeah. So what's your prayer?
My prayer is that, you know, we, all the people in our country, anybody who's listening to this lives, and doesn't worry about tomorrow for tomorrow's sake, but just enjoys the moment that we're all in. Look around at the beauty of it all and remember that that's what's important, not the fear that is used to manipulate us.
And that there's enough stuff, there's enough love, there's enough if you share it. So it's not just enjoying it at the expense of others, because that's not life. That's not the life that God made us for.
No.
God made us for a life where looking out for our neighbors, there's enough.
Right. And our neighbor is everyone.
That's right. And in fact, what we'll find is so much joy.
Yep.
When we let our neighbors in to that sort of quick, you know? Well, this turned out to be kind of a hard day.
Yeah. There's no good outtakes here. Oh, well, this is good stuff.
Yeah, it is good stuff. It's hard stuff, but you know, you can tell me and Tim are in it. Me and Tim. My mother would say,
"Mean Tim."
He's not mean. Tim and I are in this with you, this struggle of figuring this stuff out.
Something we're all living in, and it's something that we all need to talk about. So grab somebody and have a coffee or a meal or a beer and just be with one another.
How about wine?
Wine. Wine's good.
Yeah. All right. See you next week.
Well, you won't see him.
Oh, that's right.
I got you.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye now.